excited to get all these texts about the gas stations. I mean, it's crazy. Thank you so much for texting in. I'll try to get to them throughout the show. 773 says, when it comes to wakes and funerals, I wish I could go. I've been ill myself. I've missed 6 in the past 3 weeks. Oof. That's a lot to miss. But yeah, we talk about 847 says a lot of funeral homes these days have open bars. Maybe they should to help people feel more at ease when they attend wakes. About that. That seems like that's a recipe for trouble. But we're talking about wakes and funerals and etiquette coming up a little bit later in the program. Also, the question whether or not what issue, above all other issues, brings you to the polls when it's election season. 312-981-7200. In studio, our resident historian, John Schmidt. He is the author of Hidden Chicago Landmarks. He joins us once a month here to talk about some of the great stories that he has written about in his great book. John, good to see you.
Glad to be here, Justin.
Yeah, so this is February, and this is Black History Month, and we thought you've got a lot of great stories about African-Americans who have a little hidden history, is some stuff that's I wouldn't say underreported necessarily, but stories that the whole book is really about stories that haven't been told as much.
Well, I'll tell you something about the underreporting. First person we're talking about was Jesse Binga. And in 1980, I was teaching at the Betsy Ross School at 60th and Wabash, an African-American neighborhood, and he had lived a few blocks from there. None of the kids knew who he was.
Yeah, well, I'll be the first to say Jesse Binga.
There was a book about him just came out the last year, so he's getting some more attention. Okay. But anyway, the kids didn't know who he was at that time 40 years ago, and he has gotten more attention since then. And his house does have a Chicago Tribune marker now. But anyway, to get to the man himself, he was born in Detroit, 1865, and he scuffled around a lot of odd jobs. He's a barber for a while. It's his father's occupation. And in 1893, he came to Chicago for the World's Fair, like Walt Disney's father and a bunch of other people. There's a lot of jobs around with the World's Fair. Well, around that time and then into the early 20th century, this was the time of the Great Migration. You had a lot of African-Americans were getting fed up with the conditions down south, and they had opportunities in the northern cities where they wouldn't suffer as much prejudice. So a lot of African-Americans were moving up north.
Yeah, from Mississippi, from Alabama, places like that.
Yeah. Now, Chicago had already had a fairly small black population, 2%, 5%, something like that, in the early 20th century. And the area where the African-Americans lived were on the near south side from about 22nd Street, Cermak Road, down around 35th, 39th, on either side of State Street. They called it the Black Belt. It was a narrow area. But with all these people coming in, they needed some place to live. And so the area where the new residents were started to expand out sideways in various directions.
Right.
And this panicked a lot of the white people, because it's a time of prejudice.
And this is also a time when your neighborhood was really ethnically driven. You had a German neighborhood, an Irish neighborhood. I read a great book about this, and it was all about the sort of near south side neighborhoods. And as African-Americans who were really just shoved into one area, even went a block over, these roving gangs and other things that were protecting those neighborhoods did not like
that. Oh, yeah, that's the 1919 race riot.
Right.
But this is, around the same era, going back a little. Well, what Jesse Binga did, he got on the ground floor of this type of thing. He would buy a property at rock bottom price for one of these panicky whites that wanted to get out, and then he'd fix it up, and he put his own sweat equity in. He'd do most of the work himself so he could save money. And if it was a big place, he might subdivide it, and then he would either rent it out or he would sell it to another.
And this was a big deal because the buildings that were being rented to African Americans at the time were terrible. They were just awful. Like try to shove as many people in, and like we said,
he was providing better living conditions for them. So naturally, he became prosperous as time went by, and he was making so much money in 1908. He became the first African-American in Chicago to open a privately owned bank. It was called the Binga Bank. It was at 36th and State. It was, as I said, it was Chicago's first black-owned bank, and it was very successful with this. He started operating his real estate business through the bank. As a matter of fact, if you look through old copies of the Broad Axe, which was a black newspaper then, or the Chicago Defender. I've got one of the ads in the book. It told all the things that Jesse Binger's bank would do for you, all the real estate transactions that even manage your property for you. If you were a non-resident owner, they'd charge a fee, and you didn't have to worry about anything.
A lot of things that the white banks weren't doing for black people at the time.
Now, Jesse decided in 1910, he decided he would go into politics. And he ran for a seat on the Cook County Board of Commissioners. And 4 years before Ferdinand Barnett, Ida Wells Barnett's husband, had run for judge, and he'd been defeated. Well, Jesse runs in 1910. And he runs as a Republican. That was the party of choice for African Americans in those days. And he lost. And that was the only time he tried for elective office. But, he was doing okay, making a lot of money and so on.
Right.
So 1917, he decides to move into a new house. And it was at 5922, it's King Drive today, then it was called South Park Avenue. Well, it's a white neighborhood. Hmm. He's the first African-American in the neighborhood. And he starts getting death threats. People start throwing bombs at the place. The local cops were kind of slow about this. They, they didn't care. So finally, Binger used his own money. He hired 24-hour guards to guard his property. And his friends told him, why don't you move out of there? And he said, why should I move? He said, I am an American citizen, a Christian, and a property owner. No man can make me a traitor or a coward. No power on earth can change my faith in God. I'm going to defend my home and my personal liberty, the extent of my life. I have just as much right to live in my home in Washington Park as anybody else.
Yeah.
And it took years before the violence finally stopped. And after a while, he was settled there. Well, 1920s, this was the big prosperous time for him. And again, he builds now another building, the Binger Arcade at State and 35th. And it has five stories. It has stores, professional buildings. It has a dance hall. He recharges his bank. Now it's the Binger State Bank. And he's celebrated as the richest black man in Chicago and probably, at that time, the richest black man in the whole United States.
Hmm.
But 1929, stock market crashes. Binger had been planning to try and get a charter as a national bank. Stock market, of course, wipes things out. Binger State Bank was wiped out. Binger himself loses money on this. He's brought up to trial for embezzlement. Two trials. The first trial was a hung jury. The second trial, he was convicted. He served some time. There's a lot of evidence that it was trumped up charges, that there was racial prejudice was involved in this. But he did go to prison. And he was finally let out on parole. And in 1941, Governor Dwight Green gave him a pardon because of the way things had been done. Well, he spent his final years in his neighborhood, still living in the house. And he spent his final years as the janitor at St. Anselm's Catholic Church, which was the neighborhood, $15 a week, this multimillionaire.
Wow.
And he
what
died.
A life.
Yeah, he died in 1950. And today there's a Chicago Tribune marker in front of his house.
On King Drive.
Yeah, yeah. And a book came out last year about Jesse being a finally, after all these years, somebody wrote a whole book about it. And the title of the book is, I forget the subtitle, but Binger is the main title. Mm. That's the thing to look for if you want to find out more about
Jesse Binger, and you can go find it. So they do have a tribute marker. Most a lot of places don't in your book, but this place does have a tribute
that
marker.
That one has a tribute marker. And as I said, when I was teaching in a neighborhood 40 years ago,
nobody knew about it.
Few people knew about it, but not many.
Historian and author John Schmidt, the book is called Hidden Chicago Landmarks, a former Chicago high school teacher who has written a great book about hidden Chicago landmarks. We're talking about Black History Month. That was Jesse Binger. We'll take a break. Mahalia Jackson and Joe Lewis, their stories coming up next here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. John Schmidt is here, our resident historian, the author of Hidden Chicago Landmarks, telling some of the great stories. I saw today in the news, I was going to mention to you, that one of the stories you had about the Niles Leaning Tower. It's up for a landmark status. It was in the paper today about landmark status. It was in the Tribune.
Oh, we got to talk more about that in the future.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
It's in the book. A lot of great stories about the hidden history of our area. John Schmidt, of course, a great historian in Chicago and a one-time Chicago high school teacher. Let's talk about, we're talking about Black History Month. We just talked about Jesse Binger. One of the I mean, if I were going to do the music tournament for the best Chicago musicians of all time, Mahalia Jackson would be a number one seed.
Oh, definitely.
She is
definitely.
The great gospel singer. She finds her way into your book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Her house, northwest corner, Indiana Avenue and 84th Street. Well, she moved to Chicago from the South with the during the Great Migration. She was 16 years old when she came, 1927. And at first, she opened a beauty shop, a beauty salon, flower shop. But, of course, her real talent was as a gospel singer. Now, she used to like to practice her singing while she was at night, while she was cooking and cleaning up the house and so on. Well, she was very loud. And the landlord would complain about it. And he said, oh, you have a wonderful voice, but, you know, can you tone it down? I can't tone it down. That's the way I sing. So she figured, well, she'd go buy an apartment building. And then she'd the landlord. She wouldn't be bothered by anybody. Well, she gets into the apartment building. The tenants start complaining. You're a nice lady, a great singer, and everything, but you're too loud, you know. So what are we going to do? So she decides, well, I got to buy my own house. So 1956 is the year, and she starts looking for a house in the South Side, in the Chatham neighborhood, around 84th in Indiana, as I said. And there are all kinds of for sale signs in the neighborhood as she's driving along, but every time she goes into a house with the for sale sign, the real estate person would say, oh, we just sold this house. That's too bad.
And at this point, she's already a famous singer at this point. This is the 50s. She's already a famous singer, so she's being discriminated against.
Yeah,
so she's one of the biggest stars in music.
Yeah, and also the Supreme Court had passed a law, I think it was 1948, against restrictive covenants where you could not say that the house could only be sold to white people or whatever.
This is how real estate got around it.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, it was just sold. It was all white neighborhood. And so finally what she does is she goes to another real estate agent, and finally she gets some cooperation. And there's a white surgeon who was selling his house in northwest corner of Indiana in 84th. And he finds out who's going to buy the house. He says, I'll be proud to sell to Mahalia Jackson. So she buys the house. $40,000, which is maybe $370,000, $380,000 today's money. Well, she's famous, but the white neighbors complain about it.
No, she's singing too loud?
No, they are prejudiced.
Oh, they're just prejudiced.
They're just prejudiced. Now, there's a Catholic priest in the neighborhood. He's trying to calm down people. They can't see, calm down. Their home prejudice is still hitting them. She gets hostile phone calls at night. Protest meetings.
She's a gospel singer.
Yeah. Somebody fired bullet holes. Well, I suppose it's an improvement over Jesse Binga's time because the police at least came out and they guarded her house. She didn't have to hire
her own guards.
But still, come on. And she says in her autobiography later, I hadn't intended to start a crusade. All I wanted was a nice, pretty home to live in. Well, finally, things kind of settled down. Not totally accepted. In 1958, Edward R. Murrow's got this program, Person to Person. He goes to celebrities' homes and interviews them in their homes. So Mahalia Jackson gets the idea. She invites some of the white kids from the neighborhood over, have some coffee and cake, and they get a chance to be on TV. And the kids come over, and they're on TV with her. And so she finally figures she's being accepted in the neighborhood. Well, she might have been accepted, but still the people have got their own prejudices. And somebody said, well, integration is the time between when the first blacks move in and the last whites move out. And that's what happened in the neighborhood. The white people moved out within a few years. And later on, 1970, as she was getting older, she moved an apartment in Hyde Park. She kept the house vacant for a year or so. And then she sold it to a young banker by the name of Roland Burris, who, of course, becomes very, very well known.
Roland Burris bought Mahalia Jackson's house?
Roland Burris did buy Mahalia Jackson's
awesome.
House. And Mahalia said at the time, well, the white people swore that we ruined the neighborhood. She said in her autobiography, but, you know, the neighborhood still looks nice. And it was 1966, she said this. And it's still a wonderful neighborhood. It's still a beautiful area on the South Side. So
there you go, Mahalia Jackson.
Prejudice
story
doesn't pay.
Also, I don't know. I would think at that time to have a celebrity like Mahalia Jackson living on your block would transcend race, but I guess not.
There's still a lot of crazy people around.
Yeah.
Well, thank God we're learning something in the intervening years. Now, Joe Lewis.
All right, Joe Lewis.
The next person. And this is another.
Before I do that, John Schmidt is with us. Hidden Chicago Landmarks is the book. It's Black History Month, and we're talking about some of the hidden stories, hidden Chicago history stories that are in John's book. All right, Joe Louis.
Okay, yeah, Joe Louis, of course, he's born in Alabama. He grew up in Detroit, and when he died, he was living in Las Vegas. But when he was heavyweight champion, he lived in Chicago.
Really?
Yeah, and he lived at 4320 South Michigan Avenue. It's funny, when I was taking a picture of the book a couple years ago, you know, man came out from the house. He said, you know, why are you taking a picture of my house? Real estate or something?
Get off my lawn, right.
Yeah, Joe Louis lived here. Joe Louis, the boxer? He didn't know that. There was no tribute. And as far as I know, there's still no tribute.
Well, because we all know Joe Louis. He's got the huge monument in Detroit.
In Detroit, yeah, the big fist.
Yeah, the big fist. Yeah. And all that. I would never think Joe Louis had any connection to Chicago.
Well, no, what happened? He was born Joe Louis Sparrow, and he dropped his last name because he didn't want his mom to know when he's amateur fighting. And he came to Chicago. His manager was John Roxborough, was a gambler in Detroit. And the reason he moved to Chicago was... Jack Blackburn was a famous trainer in Chicago, and Roxborough wanted Joe Louis to be trained by this guy, so he moved to Chicago. And he lived in an apartment off King Drive, and for a while, 1934, he started dating a lady by the name of Marva Trotter. She worked for the Defender. And that same year, well, 1935, one day, I think it was September, Joe went to New York, married Marva, Went to work then, knocked out Max Baer at his job, and then came back and rejoined himself with Marv.
Right.
Yeah, I got to go to work, honey. I'll be back. I'll try and be back quick.
Right.
Anyway, four rounds. Well, anyway, Joe and Marta had first moved to a place called the Rosenwald at 47th and Michigan Avenue. Still there. Julius Rosenwald, white philanthropist, had built this place. Well, getting back to Joe's house on Michigan Avenue, in 1936, he lost a famous bout to Max Schmeling.
Yeah.
But next year, 1937, he knocks out the Cinderella man, James J. Braddock, at Comiskey Park, becomes heavyweight champ. And Joe, in his autobiography, tells about the fact that after, you know, Marva had not gone to the fight, she'd stay and listen on the radio. And Joe, in his autobiography, says, yeah, it took me forever to drive over there to our place. And by that time, he was living at this place at 4320 South Michigan Avenue. He said, yeah, we got home, the whole neighborhood's out there. We had to keep coming out a couple of times and wave to people. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say when he bought this place, but the 1940 census says he bought it for $7,500.
Wow.
Which is like $140,000 today, and they had five. They lived in one unit, and he rented out the other five. Well, anyway, he's living in here, and World War II, of course, starts. And Joe goes in the Army, and he mostly fights exhibitions. And when the war is over, his skills are kind of deteriorated. And he has a few fights, but 1949, he retires. Well, Joe's marriage had also deteriorated over the years. You see, the ladies liked Joe, and... Joe liked the ladies, too. So in 1945, he gets divorced from Marva. They remarried the next year, and they get divorced for good in 1949. And she kept the house and the two kids. And his last years are kind of sad. He trusted too many people with his money. He had back taxes. He had to pay the IRS, and they came after him. And he had to make a boxing comeback when he showed him. It was kind of embarrassing. And he had health problems. He wound up as a greeter in a Las Vegas casino. And he died in 1981. But the building, of course, is privately owned. There is still no marker in front of it, I think. But the only thing I can think of is his favorite local golf course, which was Pipe O' Peace in Riverdale, was changed to the Joe Louis, the Champ Golf Course. And it's one of my favorites because I got my first eagle over there. So that's the... memorial we got to Joe
4320
Louis.
South Michigan. All right. Awesome. That's great. John Schmidt joins us once a month to talk about hidden Chicago landmarks. His book is called Hidden Chicago Landmarks. John, it's great to have you here every month to do these stories and to find out more about Chicago history that's not necessarily, you know, in the textbooks. These are great stories, and thanks for coming in tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.